I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's here and now. For healthcare reform, now comes the hard part. After the Senate's climactic 60-39 vote in favor of healthcare reform early today, lawmakers quickly left the Capitol for the Christmas holiday. Some of the notable quotes during the debate: House Minority Leader John Boehner said, "Not even Ebenezer Scrooge himself could devise a scheme as cruel and greedy as Democrats' government takeover of healthcare." Senator Paul Kirk, the interim successor to the late Ted Kennedy, said of his predecessor, "He's having a Merry Christmas in heaven." Much more debate is still to come. President Obama underscored the importance of the House and Senate reconciling their bills.
If passed, this will be the most important piece of social legislation since the Social Security Act passed in the 1930s, and the most important reform of our health care system since Medicare passed in the 1960s.
Joining us is the Wall Street Journal's Naftali Ben-David. And Naftali, before we talk about what's next, tell us about today. This was an extraordinary Senate vote.
It really was, and that showed in the way the vote was conducted. Every senator sat at his seat and rose to give his vote when his name was called. Vice President Joe Biden presided. It's a stark contrast to the way these votes are usually done, where senators kind of drift in and out informally over a 20-minute period, and they casually cast their votes. The air of solemnity definitely hung over the proceedings. The other thing that was interesting is Senator Kennedy's name was really invoked repeatedly, particularly by Democrats, of course. And his widow, Vicky Reggie Kennedy, was in the gallery. There was just a lot of acknowledgement that this is a cause for which he had fought over his 40-year career. And, of course, he died just a few months ago.
But we can't say it's over just yet. The House and Senate bills do have some similarities, but they have some big differences. They do both require Americans to have insurance. They both do not allow insurers to deny coverage based on pre-existing conditions. But if we look at some of the big differences, let's start with abortion. What is the split there, and how do you think both chambers might come together?
Well, it's very complex. You know, both bills aim to prevent federal funding from going toward abortions. The House goes further than the Senate in terms of restricting that and just laying down very explicit rules so that women who get any federal subsidies essentially can't buy abortion coverage. The Senate is a little bit more relaxed, but it's still language that people who favor abortion rights have a lot of problems with. And it's going to be very interesting and tricky to see how they thread that needle.
And what about the public option? The House bill has one. Senate does not.
Well, that's right. And, you know, my gut at this point would be that the House is going to have to get along without a public option. The Senate can't spare one vote. You know, 39 Democrats voted against the health care bill in the House, but not a single Democrat voted against it in the Senate. And Harry Reid, the majority leader, can't afford to lose even one of those. And I think that liberals in the House are probably going to have to come to terms with the fact that if they want any health care bill at all, it's going to have to be without anything that resembles a public option.
Well, let's talk about the third obstacle, which is how to pay for this health care overhaul. What do you think we might see there in terms of reconciling the differences between the House and Senate versions?
Well, you know, in some ways, difficult as that issue is, it's one of the easiest to split the difference on. You know, you can pay a little bit one way and a little bit another way, as opposed to abortion, which is a very difficult issue to split the difference on. So the House bill pays through it in part through a surtax on wealthy Americans. The Senate taxes high-end insurance policies and does some other things. My guess is that they'll mix and match, and they'll come up with something that pays a little bit of tribute to each of those bills.
And now, what about some of the questions that have been raised about deal-making to get this through? Democratic Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska did negotiate some provisions for his state, and he's come under fire for that. Do you think that's going to cause a problem at all?
Well, it certainly causes a little bit of a political problem for the Democrats. I mean, it's one more thing that Republicans are able to say, which is that there were all these backroom deals and midnight maneuvering and so forth. The truth is we see this pretty regularly with controversial legislation. It's not pretty. It's not attractive. But it tends to be the way these things work. My guess is that this is going to be a flare-up for a little while. But again, I think it's not something that's going to ultimately prove a major obstacle for it.
And when do you think we actually might see a vote on this?
Well, that's a good question. You know, the Senate comes back on the 20th of January. The House comes back a little bit earlier. There is a certain amount of pressure to get this done by the President's State of the Union address, whose date, I believe, has not yet been set, but it's going to be in late January or early February. They'd love to have it done by then so that the President can get up and say, look what we did. You elected us to deliver change, and we were able to follow through on that.
And at this point, what they're saying is 2013 might be the earliest that we would see any sort of change in terms of when it might take effect.
Well, one of the complex issues has been when certain things will take effect. Some things will take effect almost immediately. Democrats have made sure of that, like, for example, insurance companies not able to consider pre-existing conditions when it comes to children. But in general, this thing's going to unfold over the next few years. That's potentially a problem for the Democrats because this huge bill was passed, there was this enormous debate, and people now expect to see big changes and they expect to see some benefits. And Democrats are going to have to explain to people that these things are coming, but they're not going to be here for a few years.
Do you think that there will be a lingering divide between Republicans and Democrats because of this health care debate?
You know, I do to some degree. This has been an unusually bitter debate for the Senate. They're furious at each other for forcing this debate on Christmas Eve, and they blame each other for that. And I think they're kind of mad. I mean, you know, they'll move beyond it, and, you know, everybody's going to survive this. But there's no question this has been an unusually difficult debate, and I think one that is going to leave some lingering marks.
All right. Naftali Ben-David of The Wall Street Journal, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Our next story is about preserving the distant past with the tools of the 21st century. Benedictine monks are known as the chroniclers of the Middle Ages for their efforts to preserve the beautiful Christian manuscripts that were written at the time. Some modern-day monks are taking a page from that history, so to speak. The monks at the Hill Museum and Manuscript Library at St. John's Abbey and University in Collegeville, Minnesota, are working to digitize manuscripts held in monastic communities around the world. 35 million pages have been photographed since the 1960s, making it the largest project of its kind. But the project has its challenges. Father Columba Stewart is the Benedictine monk who's leading the effort. He's a historian of the early monastic period. And Father Columba, as we said, many of the monks who first copied these medieval manuscripts were Benedictine monks, too. What parallels do you draw between then and now?
I think it's fair to say that the Benedictine tradition, because it's so old, we've been around in the church for over 1,500 years now, that our tradition has developed instincts, or maybe you want to call them reflexes, for cultural preservation. So the evidence of the monks who faithfully copied texts in the Middle Ages, whether they were particularly interested in them or not, but knowing that they were, as text, important and worth copying, anything that human beings have created and written down is worth saving, even if the utility of it isn't immediately apparent.
You know, we have some photos on our website of some of the works that you're talking about and some of the things that you've digitized. And in one picture, there's a manuscript in Lebanon, and it's just completely eaten away by bookworms.
It's a beautiful image artistically because it's such an interesting graphic image. But it's also a reminder of the fragility of the things that we're working on. And even though it, oddly enough, creates this thing of great visual beauty, nonetheless, it's a manuscript that is very much at risk. Now, the worms are no longer eating it because it's been stabilized, and of course, it's been photographed. But it's a reminder of the thousands and thousands of things that are gone, and whether they were eaten by worms or whether they were burned in a fire or whether they were stolen and destroyed or stolen and put on eBay. Nonetheless, things do disappear.
And tell me, what are some of the interesting things that you've uncovered so far? Can you name one or two?
I think the way to put that in context is to talk about the regions where we work, which tend to be places where cultures interact or where frontiers are located. So you have different civilizations or empires right next to each other and things happening across those frontiers, which means you end up, for example, with some of the projects we're doing in the Middle East, particularly in southeastern Turkey, with very interesting historical records of what the arrival of the Crusaders in the 11th and 12th centuries looked like to indigenous Middle Eastern Christians, which is a very different perspective on the activity of the Crusades than the one we in the West typically have had. For example, there's a manuscript that is now in Aleppo, Syria. It's the only surviving complete copy of a Syriac chronicle. And by that, I mean basically an historical work written in Syriac, the Christian version of the Aramaic language, which is the language of Jesus. We were able to digitize it a year ago, and it's now been published in facsimile. And what you find in this manuscript are eyewitness accounts of the arrival of the Westerners at the time of the Crusades, and then the punishment that was visited upon the local Christian communities by their Muslim rulers in retaliation.
What was the punishment?
You find a note, for example, about the day that the order went out saying that church bells could no longer be rung. Hmm. And that's the kind of information that you find in historical manuscripts like that.
How do you go about doing this work? Who does it? Is it done on site, or are you doing it remotely?
It's all done on site, and this is important because communities which have treasured these manuscripts for centuries are not simply going to hand them to you to take off somewhere else to work on. And we also feel it's important that members of these particular communities, often sort of young people who come from a particular area or have connections to a monastery or a bishop, that these people learn to do the work to preserve their own tradition.
I understand that when you go into a country, you've said that you have to sort of go under the radar, if you will, when you start. Do you encounter a lot of resistance to your work initially?
There's a certain amount of suspicion. One place I can think of is the city of Mardin in southeastern Turkey, which until 1922 was largely a Christian community. Significant Armenian population. Many of the Armenians were killed or driven into exile in 1915. So Mardin today is a town of, 50, 60,000 people perhaps. And in that population, there are about 50 Christians. And this town has very significant monuments, and there are very significant manuscripts there. And we've done two projects in the area, both of which required a certain amount of visiting and establishing relationships before people trusted us to do this important work. I think my monastic identity helps. And then I think as they get to know me and understand that I do study these traditions and I'm very interested in them and that my community has great reverence and respect for their community, that helps to open the doors.
And I understand you're actually doing some work in Iraq.
We're working with local Iraqi Christians. It's obviously a place where it's very dangerous for someone to be seen as working with an American organization. So we work very quietly there, providing background support for people who do this kind of work. It's probably the place where the importance of the work we do is most poignantly evident because we all saw scenes of destruction in Baghdad and the aftermath of the invasion. And communities today continue to be very dislocated and worried about their future. Many of the Christians in Iraq have gone to the north, to the Kurdish area, where they found protection and safety in a relatively calm area. But no one knows how long that will last.
Father Columba Stewart is leading the effort to digitize ancient Christian manuscripts. He's executive director of the Hill Museum and Manuscript Library at St. John's Abbey and University in Minnesota. He'll be back with us in a minute. And later in the show, can we still see Charles Dickens' influence in the Christmas celebrations of today? Back after a break. Here and Now. Welcome back. We're speaking with Father Columba Stewart about digitizing ancient Christian manuscripts in many of the world's most dangerous and difficult to reach places, including Lebanon and isolated mountain monasteries in Ethiopia. Father Columba is a Benedictine monk and executive director of the Hill Museum and Manuscript Library at St. John's Abbey and University in Minnesota. And Father Columba, since 2003, more than 16,000 manuscripts have been photographed. What's your sense of the work left to do? Are there a lot more manuscripts out there?
Well, there are plenty more out there. We probably worked our way through about half of what we know to be in the Middle East. But, of course, you keep finding more. And there are also a lot of manuscript collections that are kind of off the screen because they're held by private families or they were never known to Western scholars or experts in the field. In places like Ethiopia, many of the monastic communities and churches have changed very little since the Middle Ages. It's a remarkably untouched religious culture. One of the pictures that we often use in our own material is a scene that we came upon in northern Ethiopia, going to visit an ancient capital, which had long been relegated to a dusty little town called Yaha. And we arrive and we turn up unannounced, small group of us, and there are three boys sitting in the dirt reading a manuscript. And around the corner is a priest sitting under a tree in the shade with another copy of the same text, and they're learning how to read their ancient language using something that we would put immediately in a museum or a rare book room. But for them, it's the only book they had. I was moved. There in front of our eyes was the chain of cultural transmission as these small boys, I mean, I'm talking 6 or 7 years old, are being taught to read this ancient language, which is no longer spoken, but is used in the liturgy and for theological texts. They're being taught to read it in exactly the same way people have been taught to read it for centuries.
You know, talking about some of the images here of some of the works, one of them certainly highlights the importance of the work that you do. There's a picture of an ancient manuscript here with Scotch tape on it.
You know, it's a sort of shocking thing for the modern rare book librarian to see things like that. But on the other hand, it's a sign that people have tried to take care of these the best way they could. And when you realize these are typically very, very poor communities, that these manuscripts, like the people who take care of them, have been sort of shuttled around, sometimes across national boundaries within the last 100 and so years. The fact that anything survived is itself miraculous.
Can you give me another example of a manuscript that you found and why it's significant?
Well, let me say a little bit about the work that we did in the 1970s and 80s in Ethiopia, which was the first project that our library did outside of Europe. So this was at a time when Ethiopia was descending into the revolution and then the civil war, which ultimately led to the independence of Eritrea. And we photographed about 9,000 manuscripts in a very intense microfilm campaign in those years. They've been cataloged over the last 30 years since that project began. We're still working on the cataloging. But in the process, they've discovered the oldest known copy of every book of the Bible in the ancient Ethiopian language of Ge'ez. And this is very important for biblical studies because often these ancient translations of the Bible preserve elements of the original text which were lost in later manuscript copying. So that's a direct connection then to a pretty fundamental area of religious research and study. Just speaking generally about Ethiopian manuscript illumination, that's a tradition which has a very interesting mix of local artistic traditions, which look to a Western eye like folk art, but also equally influenced by European iconography, because there were Italian missionaries in Ethiopia already in the 16th century. And so you often find in Ethiopian art interesting traces of Western images which have been completely reinterpreted in the native idiom.
What would you say is one of the most surprising things, either within the manuscripts themselves or in this journey of digitizing them that you've come across?
The most surprising things, I think, would be realizing how much is left of ancient Christian culture, even in places where the human community has dwindled considerably. I think apart from that, the most surprising thing is just realizing that there are ways that we can partner with people in the Middle East which are constructive and lead to greater understanding. And that's something I'm incredibly grateful for.
Aside from bookworms, what would you say are some of the other significant threats to these documents?
Well, there's the obvious one of violence. So, you know, war has certainly destroyed many, many manuscripts, whether it's through fire or bombing. In this day and age, another threat to manuscripts is the black market. And so if you go on eBay any day of the week, you can find Ethiopian manuscripts, for example, for sale. And these are, without exception, illegally exported because it's for quite some time it's been illegal to take things out of the country without permission. And even if you go to, say, a hotel gift shop in Ethiopia, you'll find manuscripts for sale.
Father Columba, thanks very much for being with us.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Father Columba Stewart is Executive Director of the Hill Museum and Manuscript Library at St. John's Abbey and University in Collegeville, Minnesota. To see images of some of the manuscripts that Father Columba is working with, go to our website, hereandnow.org. And this note, it appears that many modern-day Christians put off much of their Christmas shopping until the last minute. Nationally, stores have been packed all week, and procrastinators are out in force this Christmas Eve. Many retailers on the East Coast revised their hours to accommodate shoppers who were slammed by a winter storm this past weekend. For the season overall, shoppers are coming back in a modest way. Holiday sales are expected to be a little better than a year ago. Fourth quarter profits for many merchants should look pretty good because they did not have to cut prices more than they planned. They were cushioned by leaner inventories than in years past. One analyst told the Associated Press today, it's finally feeling a lot like Christmas. The news is up next, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. On this day before Christmas, we bring you a story from Bethlehem. It's about a home for single mothers who aren't able to raise their children. The home is called La Creche, or The Manger, and it provides the same sort of sanctuary the manger offered in the biblical Christmas story. The BBC's religious affairs correspondent Christopher Lando prepared this report.
These nuns singing in a chapel in Bethlehem spend their lives devoted to an extremely practical mission, offering a home for around 50 children whose prospects would otherwise be desperate. They're assisted by a team of Palestinian carers and some international volunteers.
My name is Chris. I'm from California. And I first visited the creche about 2 years ago on a school field trip. And really loved it, fell in love with the kids, fell in love with what they do here. So I graduated in May, and I got here in September, and I'm here for 6 months. I am.
And you've got a real fan there.
Yeah, oh yeah, we're buddies. Hi, Ehab. Ehab is deaf, almost completely deaf. And so it's a silent world he lives in, so when he sees somebody he recognizes, he gets pretty excited.
And like many of the children here, he's facing a pretty tough start in life, isn't he?
Yeah, it's not ideal. I mean, he's growing up in an orphanage without parents anyway, and then you put on top of that that he can hardly hear anything. It's definitely tough for him.
As social worker Iskander Andon told me, Ehab has inherited his hearing problem from his mother, who's 16, profoundly deaf, unable to speak, severely limited socially. She was extremely vulnerable.
Simply, she was raped by at least three of her cousins and neighbors, and she got pregnant. And some of the family, her uncle actually, he brought her to the creche for help, and we helped them. So Ehab, he born almost 32 weeks, which is good in such cases. And here we are, he's improving very well.
The story of Ehab's mother is sadly typical. Staff at the creche estimate that up to half the women who come here for help are pregnant as a result of sexual abuse within the family, including incest. In their office, Elizabeth Aboulaban and her senior colleague, Juria Salawi, who's responsible for education at the creche, try to engage with four-year-old Ahmed, one of the most challenging children in their care.
Ahmed is a little boy who is here since 2 months. They came and his brother in emergency because the father wanted to burn them or to kill them or I know. And Ahmed is in a big, big crisis. He's completely lost. He didn't found his place till now.
He refused to enter the classroom. He refused to play with anything. So even he makes out sounds with his voice, like, only sounds, to realize that I am suffering. I'm not okay.
And yesterday, Ahmed was pushing a little boy in the class, and that boy fell down on his head. Ahmed was sitting in such a darkness. I mean, you could feel that he just can't deal with everything. in that moment, I feel really it's for me just a chance. I'm blessed that I can carry that child. Sometimes it's really too much, you know. Those kids are suffering, and we just can do nothing enough to help them.
However problematic their background, the children themselves are, of course, blissfully unaware of their origins. Children like Ihab. His young mother didn't even understand she was pregnant, and though he's inherited her deafness, he has a zest for life.
He's like telling us, don't worry about my past, don't worry about my history, don't worry about my mom. Just forget about all this and put it behind my back, and I need to see the future. He's a very happy baby, and this is part of our reward, actually, to see the product of such difficult situations, happy and seeking pleasure and good future.
That report from the BBC's Christopher Lando. Up next, did Charles Dickens invent some of our Christmas traditions? Back in a bit, here and now. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Hold on, one sec now.
Santa Claus has been making the rounds and getting wish lists before the big night tonight. Among his stops this week was a visit to the Jimmy Fund Clinic at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. This Santa, a.k.a. Jonathan Meath, met with some loyal fans there, like 6-year-old Hannah Lowe.
What would you like for Christmas?
A Barbie doll house.
A Barbie doll house? With the car or without the car?
Without it.
Without the car, okay.
I mean, yeah, with it.
With it, maybe. And you have Barbies already?
I can't find them.
Oh, can't find them right now. Well, maybe you'll need another Barbie.
But 6-year-old Sam Pollard was still undecided.
Anything special on your Christmas list?
I don't know because I haven't made it up yet.
That's okay. Whenever you have an idea of what you'd like, you can just whisper to me. Just say, Santa, I know what I'd like. And I'll hear.
Santa also spoke with 5-year-old Elton Rhines and his mom. Elton is hoping for action figures this year, and he said he's pretty sure he'll get them.
I've been good.
He's been very good. He's been got diagnosed in February with Wilms tumor, and now, 10 months later, we're done our chemo, and we just got good news last week, good scans. So we're going to have a good Christmas.
And though these children have serious health concerns, Santa says when it comes to Christmas, they're still kids.
It's not been my experience at all that these kids ask for anything different than other kids. Yes, they are having trouble with their health, but kids are kids. They ask for the same things. Barbies, Legos, Bakugan, and Zuzu pets are very big this year.
We also asked Santa about whether the economy is affecting wish lists for the kids or for their parents.
I haven't seen any effect of the economy in terms of the requests that I'm getting. The parents may make little jokes about the economy, but really, kids' requests are kids' requests. They're focused on their needs, their wants, and they see Santa as a bringer of joy. Isn't it a great thing?
That's Santa Claus, a.k.a. Jonathan Meath, at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. Another much-loved holiday staple is Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. This year, Disney gave the story a 3D IMAX animated update. Jim Carrey voices the miser Ebenezer Scrooge, with Gary Oldman as his late business partner Jacob Marley, whose ghost gives Scrooge some unwelcome news one Christmas Eve.
He will be haunted by 3 spirits. That's the Charlton Hoop. I'd rather not.
Expect the first tomorrow when the bell tolls 1.
Can't I take them all at once and have it over with, Jacob?
Expect the second the next night at the same hour. And the third upon the next night when the last stroke of 12 has ceased to vibrate.
As many of us know from the familiar story, those Christmas spirits helped Scrooge reform his cold-hearted ways and showed him how others celebrate the holidays. Well, author Les Standiford says the celebrations in A Christmas Carol, with their ideas of community and fellowship, affected not just Scrooge, but they shaped how we mark the holiday today. Standiford's book is called The Man Who Invented Christmas, How Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol Rescued His Career and Revived Our Holiday Spirits. We spoke with Les last year, and we thought we'd revisit that conversation. We began by asking him how Dickens helped revive Christmas.
Christmas, while still on the Christian calendar docket, was a relatively minor Christian holiday at the time, looked upon generally in disfavor, and its status as a civil holiday was nil, even at the time that Dickens began to write A Christmas Carol in 1843.
I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind reading a description that you have in the book of what the holiday was before Dickens' A Christmas Carol.
There were no Christmas cards in 1843 England, no Christmas trees at royal residences or White Houses, no Christmas turkeys, no department store Santa or his million clones, no outpouring of Yuletide greetings, no week-long cessation of business affairs through the new year, no orgy of gift-giving, no ubiquitous public display of nativity scenes or court fights regarding them, no holiday lighting extravaganzas, and no plethora of midnight services celebrating the birth of a savior. In fact, despite all of Dickens' enthusiasms, the holiday was a relatively minor affair that ranked far below Easter, causing little more stir than Memorial Day or St. George's Day does today.
Can you tell me then, how was the holiday celebrated then right around the time that the book was published?
It was observed in rural enclaves by the so-called superstitious. It was a holiday that was honored in more widely in other countries, in Germany, where Victoria's new husband, Prince Albert, had come from. In fact, writers like Washington Irving and Dickens' predecessor, Sir Walter Scott, had mourned the passing of a Christmas which they saw vestiges of in their travels through the far-flung countryside. But when Dickens came along, he said, well, yes, you're right, we've lost that holiday, but he was very proactive. We're going to bring it back.
Let's talk about sort of specific traditions. Among them, sending a turkey. In the story, A Christmas Carol, Scrooge sends a turkey to his clerk, Bob Cratchit, at the time. That replaced the family's goose. And after that, sales of geese went down, and turkey became the staple on the Christmas table.
Yes, I read cookbooks published in the late 1850s and late 1860s, one published by the Julia Child of her time, words to the effect of, well, of course, we all know now that no Christmas dinner would be complete without a turkey at its centerpiece, not just any turkey, a formidable turkey, as Dickens asked the street urchin to go get not the little prize turkey, but the big one, one about twice the size of Tiny Tim.
And also the idea of charity at this time of year, looking back and helping those less fortunate during the Christmas holiday. This was something that Dickens also felt very strongly about. Do you think that this also made that idea more popular at the time?
I don't think there's any question of it. This book was set at one point in the late 19th and early 20th century to have become second only to the Bible in readership, in the language. The message here is clear of the strength and comfort to be found in familial relationships and the need to help those less fortunate than you, no matter how difficult your times may be.
We'll have more with author Les Standiford in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to Here and Now. We're revisiting our conversation with author Les Standiford about the continuing popularity of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. This year, there's a Disney IMAX 3D version of the story, the latest of hundreds of adaptations of the Dickens classic. Here's a scene from the 1984 TV version with George C. Scott as Scrooge and Roger Rees as Scrooge's nephew, Fred.
Merry Christmas, Uncle. I said, Merry Christmas, Uncle.
Humbug.
Christmas a humbug, Uncle. Surely you don't mean that.
I do.
Fred also tells Scrooge that for him, Christmas is not humbug.
But I've always thought of Christmas time when it comes round as a good time, a kindly, forgiving, charitable time. A time when men and women seem by one consent to open their shut-up hearts freely to their fellow creatures.
According to author Les Standiford, Fred's sentiments might have been those of Dickens himself. He says the Christmas holiday actually was not widely celebrated when Dickens wrote his book in 1843, and he says that was part of the inspiration behind A Christmas Carol. We asked Les if he thought Dickens intended to revive Christmas traditions.
Oh, very much the intent. He was a great booster of Christmas, of holidays in general, and all his life had been marked with a great compassion for the downtrodden and the unfortunates, because he had been one himself, and he felt that a Christmas story at Christmas time would be the perfect way to help revitalize a populace that had been pretty well beaten down. They were in the midst of a terrible depression of their own. It was a time called the Hungry 40s in England.
Now, aside from perhaps renewing the idea of Christmas and bringing forth some of these traditions for the holiday, Dickens himself was also facing some financial difficulty at the time. And one of the reasons that he wrote the book and wrote it so quickly was because he needed the money.
Well, I think that's part of it. He had been at the top of his game. He was selling 100,000 copies of an issue of the old Curiosity Shop, and that had fallen to about 20% just 3 or 4 years later. As a result of a couple of bum books, American Notes, his travelogue in the United States, and Martin Chuzzlewit. And one of the things was he needed money, but he also realized that he may have gotten it wrong in those last two books, and he might have begun to talk down to and preach to his readers. And he thought that he had found the perfect combination, a story that meant something that would also appeal to an audience. And yet, when he went to his publisher, all excited to tell them about it, they said, Dickens, nobody much celebrates Christmas here. Why don't you just lie down until that urge to write a ghost story of Christmas passes? We'll put out a cheap edition of some of the work that of yours that people used to like to read.
He actually had to agree to underwrite a lot of the costs of publishing the book, didn't he?
Well, at first, he was so disheartened by their response, he threatened in a letter to his agent, John Forster, that he would just give up writing altogether and move to the continent and become a travel writer. The idea of A Christmas Carol would not let go of him, and so he staked the last little bit of money he had to publish the book himself, an exercise in what today we would call the last resort of the desperate author, vanity publishing.
Mm-hmm. You know, some of the themes in the book, the theme against ignorance and themes of charity and familial relationships, some of those have been certainly themes in his previous works. So where do you think A Christmas Carol stood in terms of his own fondness for his work?
He was very proud of how it turned out. The most scathing critic of the time, William Thackeray, said of it, in fact, who can listen to objections regarding such a book as this? It seems to me a national benefit, and to every man or woman who reads it, a personal kindness.
You know, some of the images from A Christmas Carol, certainly the images of family fellowship in the Cratchit family gathering together, even though they were very poor, that was not Dickens' childhood experience.
Dickens had a tough time of it as a child. His father was put in debtor's prison, his whole family, in fact, thrown into debtor's prison, all but Dickens himself, who stayed out at age 12 to take a job in a shoeblacking factory in order to try to buy his father out of prison.
And then was the Cratchit family in A Christmas Carol sort of his ideal?
Well, I believe they represent a kind of closeness and love that he wished he had had himself. You know, he had a brother who was sickly, probably suffered from rickets, which might well be what Tiny Tim suffered from. His brother's nickname was Tiny Fred, and we can only be grateful that Dickens had the good sense to name his character Tiny Tim instead of Tiny Fred. It just does not have the same ring to it, does it?
No, not at all. In terms of Dickens' own family life as an adult, Do you think that he valued those relationships and had those types of relationships in his adult family life?
I think he tried. One of the things that he did realize as an adult was that what had landed his father in prison was that he wasn't a very good manager of his money. And while he was very sympathetic as a 12-year-old to have his father in jail and wanted to do everything that he could to get him out, he came to realize that his father was the sort of fellow who earned 20 pounds a year but always spent 21. And Dickens' family looked to him, particularly after Dickens began to have some success as a writer, to always make up for their shortfall.
Hmm. Sounds like maybe he identified with both sides in A Christmas Carol, Dickens himself, a little bit with Scrooge and a little bit with the Cratchit family.
He actually talked about it at times and would claim in letters that he himself was not preoccupied with money. But in other letters and bits of writing, you see that he was a meticulous record keeper and always worried that he might not stay in good financial health. Again, having had that experience as a child and then having gone broke after you'd reached the heights of literary Olympus, you have some compassion for the man. He believed that at any moment it could all go away.
But overall, you think that this story and Dickens' story, regardless of maybe how much of his own personal experience he may be putting forth or wishing may have been different here, it still has appeal for audiences even today. There have been hundreds of stagings and dramas of A Christmas Carol. Why does it continue to have that appeal, do you think?
Well, because I think that readers now as then understand that they get in Dickens, and particularly in this tale, not only a great story, wonderful characters, terrific writing. The humor is as modern as it can be. But they also get an unflinching view of the moral universe that surrounds us. And his call on the need for charity and the strength to be found in the love of family is enduring to this day. And proof of that is the way that the book has entered the very fabric of our society. It's hard to imagine anyone in the Western world who isn't familiar with some form or another of Bah Humbug going up against God Bless Us Everyone.
Author Les Standiford. His book is The Man Who Invented Christmas, How Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol Rescued His Career and Revived Our Holiday Spirits. We spoke with him last year.